The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play the country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Yes, here we are. International week day two. Dan McDonald, how are you coping? Day 3 to day 2. It's all so exciting. I can't keep on top of it.
I like international breaks. I'm sick of people knowing about them.
Well,
most of them are.
Well, Dan, they're not all that exciting for a huge proportion of the week.
No, I know that. There's a slow build-up. But yeah. I mean, you know, international breaks are part of what leads you to like international tournaments and stuff like that.
I enjoy the tournaments.
Really good. But like, you know, this is all part of the process.
I understand that.
And it's like, not everything can be caviar and steak, Joe. Like sometimes you just got to have a sandwich. You got to have a sandwich out of a shop.
We've known each other a long time. That's the most profound thing you've ever said. So good on you.
Yeah, although you wouldn't actually have caviar and steak together, which suggests that I haven't done that before.
I wouldn't have even known that. I wouldn't have even known that, Dan. Yeah. So there you go. Can you get a caviar sandwich in a shop? Probably not.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say you'd get it in your sort of spa or centre with your chicken fillet roll.
Chicken and stuffing, please, every time.
And some caviar, please. Yeah. You know.
So listen, Dan, exciting times. To get you through International Week Day 3, #Day 3, or for those of you who want something to get them through International Week Day 3. Tim Vickery's going to join us later on. Okay. Well, in truth, I've spoken to him already. That's why you won't be part of that interview. It was before you came in.
You're breaking the fourth wall there, John.
To give the ghost away too much. So Brazil play Argentina this Friday in a friendly, naturally enough, in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, I mean,
where else would you
play? It's the heartbeat of the football world.
So Tim's going to talk to us about all that. Messi's back for Argentina. He had a 3-month ban, so he's back after comments he made about corruption. And Tim says that the real issue for Brazil, who, by the way, have lost 5 on the bounce, is how to get the best from Firmino, who has Liverpool playing all around him, whereas for Brazil, they're expecting little Bobby to lead the line. Mm. And that's ending with predictable results. He's getting the absolute snot kicked out of him. So Tim will join us in about 25 minutes or so. A few things to get through. We'll start with Ireland camp. I know you're in and around it day in, day out.
What are you talking about?
Yes.
Are you breaking into football cliche mode here?
No.
Day in, day out.
Day in, day out.
Just in the morning, actually, for an hour, to be precise, and then they get rid of us before they do the interesting training.
Fair enough. Exactly, yeah.
They've named the team for this game.
Well, that's exciting.
They've realised that, I don't know. I mean, maybe they just wanted to name the team, and I'm just suggesting it might help for the sake of ticket sales and stuff, that people know for certain that, you know, I think it's one of these things that, and I'm not saying that's Mick McCarthy's factor at all. You might just want to let the players know. And in fact, like privately, I think you probably would let some of these players know they're going to start so they can prepare for it anyway.
Well, I'm sure you were out with Jack Byrne and his mother, obviously.
Yeah.
Jack was in here and he said ahead of his debut at the Aviva Stadium, Mick told him.
He knew.
And he said, if you want to let your family know, and also to prepare yourself.
You can. So I think with this game, it's probably helpful. I think some people might be sceptical, or maybe Jack might only get half an hour, or Parrott might only get half an hour, or whatever. So they very much said, no, we are playing these players. So they have the other team for tomorrow.
Give us the team, Dan.
So Kieran O'Hara is in goals. Burton Albion's Kieran O'Hara on loan from Manchester United. Leo Connor, Celtic, right full, makes his debut as well. He's only here because he's suspended for the under-21 game in Armenia. So they brought him in.
What age is he?
Leo Connor is under 20. I think he's 19 or maybe 1920. Okay. Leo Connor, I think he's 1920. Waterford fellow. I was sort of compared to John O'Shea because he's versatile and went to Man U very young.
And from Waterford.
Yeah, exactly. And they were the comparisons. But a shocking nice fellow by all accounts as well.
Yes, it is John O'Shea.
He ticks all the boxes, but except for the fact he's been let go to Celtic, and he's still making. He hasn't played actually at club level yet, a senior game. But he starts tomorrow.
Good.
Then central defence, Kieran Clark is back and plays with Kevin Long. No real surprise there. Left full, Derek Williams plays. The recurring theme here is that most of these people aren't going to play against Denmark on Monday, which might be bad news for some of the players in midfield. So in midfield, Alan Brown starts in the centre with Josh Cullen as the sort of two, I guess. Slight surprise. What does that mean? You would probably, if you were Conor Hourihan, who's lost your place to Alan Brown in Switzerland, you might actually take this as good news. that Alan Brown is playing tomorrow and you're not, although McCarthy did suggest that there might be one or two maybe in contention from one to the next. Right side is Robbie Brady, who's very much in that zone, and the feeling would be he's trying to get minutes under his belt with a view to breaking into the side. Jack Byrne is going to play as the most advanced in the midfield three, and then on the left side you've got Sean Maguire, and then through the top you've got Troy Parrott, 17-year-old Troy Parrott, the youngest debutant since Robbie Keane in 1998, third youngest player of all time to start a player for Ireland. Jimmy Holmes was the youngest. So I mean, between Troy Parrott, Jack Byrne in particular, Sean Maguire the left side, I guess Lee O'Connor, although he's more of a lower profile figure and he's a right full, so he's not necessarily someone that's going to thrill you, but I think the Troy Parrott aspect in particular will add something to this match, and I think the Jack Byrne story as well will add some interest to a game that it is a hard sell. He wanted to mind everyone else really, but Monday in mind, I think that's understandable given that the success or failure of his year depends on Monday, so he's not going to weaken his hand for that by injuring someone here. So yeah, I guess maybe it's worth debating, you know, the Alan Brown thing, for example. Does that mean that maybe he might be more off a bench option than Monday, or who knows, maybe he could be excellent tomorrow and we could be overthinking this.
So Troy Parrott then, he's the big talking point for obvious reasons. Mm. And we played a clip last night, if you missed it, of Mick talking the previous day, which would have been hashtag day one of the international
week. Yeah, that's what it was, 3 days, Joe.
Yeah. And he was saying at that stage, you're asking about Troy Parrott, can I see a training session with him first? Mm. Was his very fair point. So clearly he liked what he saw. So here's Mick today talking about Troy Parrott.
Oh, a bright, very intelligent footballer that's really good with the ball at his feet. He did some really good things yesterday. I think he found it tough enough. We had a pretty hard session. They hadn't done anything over the weekend, so they had a fairly intense one. But he enjoyed it. He's very capable, there's no doubt about that. Doesn't take a special kind to be pitched in. It takes a special kind when they are pitched in to thrive, to do well, to make an impression, a good impression, impress everybody. And I hope that's going to be the case with Troy. I mean, you know, Robbie did it instantly and continued to do it, of course, for how many years and how many caps and how many goals.
And what kind of help can Robbie be to a young striker like Troy trying to make his way at this level?
Oh, Robbie's a help to all the strikers, and he was working with some of them yesterday and he'll be doing some more this morning. He was working with Troy for a while yesterday. I think any information he can give in terms of the movement, he was one of the best, Robbie, his movement, to get himself chances. You can help them in terms of finishing because you can give them tips. TC is fantastic at that. But just the all-round play of a striker, Robbie's been one of the best. And if you can't learn from him, he's not going to learn from anybody.
Very interesting. Because actually when Robbie Keane did the Gary Neville soccer box thing recently, he talked about his movement being his real strength above all else. You know, yeah. And when he went to Liverpool, Rafa Benitez questioned his movement, and this was not taken well at all.
Heresy.
Yeah. To the point where he told the story about Benitez sent him downstairs into the video room to play with, and Robbie made the point himself, somebody who had never played the game, to sit there and point out where his movement wasn't good. And Keane had scored in one of the games they were talking about, to the point where he said, well, look at the goal I scored. Get that open screen. Let's have a look at this movement. So the fact that he's working with Parrott, fantastic. I mean, if you can, I mean, Mick's saying you can't teach someone how to finish necessarily, maybe you can improve it or not, but if he feels you can help with a player's movement, geez, he's learning from someone very adept at that. McCarthy, and you would have, I'm sure, seen this because you were there for the full press conference when he talked about how he did in training. He said, I don't think I've seen his full potential yet in the couple of days training sessions we've had, but he did something yesterday. When the ball came into him, he turned, he got a shot off, was terrific. And you could just see from that little cameo that he's got something special. So he's obviously done well.
I'd love to know what he did. That was referenced once or twice. I mean, I've got all these scenarios in my head now, you know, where he's taking the ball, some kind of Cruyff turn on the run, flicked it over someone's head and got a shot away. I mean, that might not have been what happened.
Aidan McGeady against Georgia.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
To be fair, what I first thought was ball into him. And you know the way you can catch a ball on the bounce? I think he Cruyff turned the bounce and that got him turned away from the defender. And then he hooked one in with the right foot. That's what I'm seeing, Dan.
You think so? I mean, the thing about Parrott is that, I mean, obviously there's the natural Robbie comparison, but, and then the movement thing is interesting because that obviously was Robbie's strength, but he's a different sort of shape, you know. He's not necessarily like a poacher, you know. He's not sort of, like, he's a big enough fella. Like, he's actually, when you see him, he's sort of quite imposing for a 17-year-old. Robbie Brady referenced that sort of frame yesterday. He's played, I mean, he's played as a 10 a lot for Irish international teams behind like a number 9. Certainly with the 21s, he's played both as a number 10 behind and even on the left side. So he hasn't necessarily, whereas tomorrow he's going to be in the centre of a front three, it seems. So,
And Jack Byrne will be occupying that space.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, Sean Maguire is a very positive selection on the left side. So, like, you know, the comparisons aren't really like for like between him. I mean, the comparisons are unfair anyway, but it's just, and like, in fairness, he does have a habit also of scoring goals like a goal poacher. I'm just saying that he's not necessarily going to be sniffing round like Robbie Keane style. He'll be getting it, he'll be dropping deep to get involved. And I was at his game when he played for Spurs against Colchester. A different type of match, because Colchester were like a League Two team trying to frustrate the big guns, you know, and they sat as deep as possible. So Parrott, as a result, just went wandering to just try and get the ball and get involved, because he was getting frustrated. There was no space at all in the game for him to sort of stretch in any way, to stretch his legs in the last third. So it's possible tomorrow's game could be a bit more open. It's a bit weird. New Zealand haven't played a game in 18 months, which is a bizarre product of the Oceania region where they play. They don't necessarily have like a strong Confederations tournament to keep them active. So like, they're basically, it's all about a build towards a World Cup cycle, really. So they haven't played in a long period of time, which is very bizarre. And obviously this is an Ireland team that hasn't played together before. So it could maybe be sort of an open, atypical type of, you know, scenario, or untypical, sort of in the context of a regular Ireland game where you think of it being tight and well contested or so on. Actually, that Bulgaria game in September was pretty open and free, and it's particularly, you know, the second half of the game, and it's very possible this game could be like that.
Okay. Anything else of note?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, they are the main talking points. I think Parrott, I think Jack Byrne starting the game. Areas of the pitch, it's more like Kieran Clarke and Kevin Long. It's just, I don't think they're going to play on Monday, put like that.
One other thing, I was reading the 42. Stephen Hunt's been doing various media over the last couple of days. Enjoying Coppers with Kevin Kilbane was one of his big lines.
Yeah, I haven't gotten into reading that piece.
Coppers. No, that's not what I want to talk to you about, but me and Kev have been to Coppers more since we were tired than in our playing days by distance. And then he seemed to have been out in Coppers with Kev and Kev's new Dancing on Ice partner recently.
Right.
And he was remarking upon the difference between her dancing, whereby, and I've never seen this in Coppers, Dan, and either had Stephen Hunt, whereby the dance floor separated and opened out to watch Kev's dance partner perform some audacious skills. Meanwhile, as Stephen said, Kev was propping up the bar, not quite dancing to the same standard. So he was looking forward to seeing how things go.
Okay, I haven't heard this, but
that's a glorious scene.
They all parted. Imagine that video for Run DMC back in the day, where everyone, then all of a sudden,
isn't,
you know, just Kev or Hunt.
It's a very well organised Copper situation. However, Stephen Hunt was also talking.
They weren't the Lilies anyway, they were players, to be fair. Copper's has only become a real venue for footballers in the last decade.
It's the GAA thing.
You're factually correct.
Yeah, it's true. He didn't mention Lilies.
The venue.
Other nightclubs are available. Anyway, Hunt was talking about Shane Long. And he was saying, you know, Mick McCarthy had a great relationship with him, obviously played for him at Wolves and Ipswich, but definitely things, you know, Long, been left out of recent squads, he's still only 32, he's had a disappointing start of the season. So he's made just 4 Premier League appearances, 3 of which have been from the bench. So he said he's left Shane Long out. To be fair to Shane, he's acted like a true professional, he hasn't moaned about it, he's just gone on with it, but he should be in it for sure, says Shane Long. In and out of Southampton's first team, granted, but he's still playing Premier League, which is only David McGoldrick and Aaron Connolly from a striker point of view playing in that division. Shane would say if he was in the Championship, he would be playing week in, week out. So what's the difference?
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument to make. I mean, I think if Ireland are chasing a goal on Monday night, and regardless of your opinion of Shane Long, there's no doubt that Shane Long's indifferent goal-scoring record has affected his standing.
Well, let's put it in more blunt terms, right? And Shane Long has had an outstanding career, and all credit to him. And he's played in the Premier League and he's scored in the Premier League. So that's not to be not cognizant of that. But there did come a point with Long and with Ireland where you felt, well, if a chance falls to him, he's not taking enough of them.
No, I know what you're saying.
And that was just the cold reality after a while. And I think it was obvious as well, his confidence really started to suffer for a period. So
There's no doubt. I mean, even the 5-1 Denmark game, he was brought on. And I think actually he got a very good chance late on. And he sort of fluffed it. He tried to chip it or something. But yeah, that's fair enough. But at the same time, I still think if the crowd saw Shane Long come on with 10 minutes to go on Monday, if Ireland were chasing the game and his pace comes on, and even if Denmark saw him coming on, they might think, God, he's going to be a bit of a pain here. I know what you're saying. He's not necessarily a guaranteed cert to take the chance that might come his way.
Yeah.
But the fact, you know, I suppose...
I would accept the point that him coming on, his pace alone would put Manners on the back four.
It definitely would. If the game was going a particular way and it was stretching a bit, although Denmark need the point. Like, there's a lot of hypotheticals, but the slight problem for Shane Long, though, in that debate is that Shane Long didn't make the Southampton matchday squad at the weekend. Michael Omafemi has. Omafemi hasn't actually made mixed squad, albeit he's pulled out of 21s with an injury. But I think, if he was going to have him around the squad, he's got 8 strikers or 9 strikers in the initial squad and Shane Long wasn't in it. I can understand why it would be offensive to Shane Long that, for example, I don't like picking out names, but like guys like James Collins and Scott Hogan, for example, haven't played in the Premier League. And I think it would rile him, and I think Stephen Hunt's point is fair, that if Shane Long was at a championship club now, he probably would be playing and probably scoring a few goals. But maybe he just feels that his lack of confidence, he needs the confident player to come in. It's a strong view. I think there are players of a generation, you know, who know Shane Long, who are quite energised by this. It hasn't become a public thing.
No.
But I think there is a thing where
I don't think there players, is. The, yeah, other players. There is no public clamour.
No. I think if Shane Long had scored a goal last weekend.
That's different.
Do you know what I mean? I think there would be.
If me and you had scored a goal last weekend, there still wouldn't be a public clamour.
No, I can't imagine either of us would stretch the Danish defence, Joe, to be honest.
It's unlikely. But if he was in red-hot form, it's a different talking point. Which you can't. There's not much to make a case on.
No. It's a weak enough case, but I mean, he has played Premier League games this year. Like, he hasn't...
4 off the bench.
Yeah. I mean, I just think there's a squad debate and a team debate, but maybe does he think if you're going to bring in someone like that and they're just patently not in your plans, does that become a problem? I don't know. That actually seems like he's going to sulk or something. I'm not saying that. It's just he's tried to obviously make some kind of clean break in this department for whatever reason. But I'm sure in due course, Shane Long, he doesn't really speak to the press, to be fair, so he's unlikely to have a forum to moan about it.
He might go on Living with Lucy again.
But you never know. Yeah. He might.
Granit Xhaka's been talking. So Xhaka obviously stripped of the Arsenal captaincy and there was the falling out a couple of weeks ago. He hasn't played since he told Arsenal fans where to go, but he's been speaking to a Swiss newspaper and he says he is not leaving. He's not going anywhere. So he says, you could say things have been a bit frantic last week in particular. It was a very special emotional experience for me, but I'm doing well again. I trained this week. I'm looking forward to my next assignments, club and country. So some of my teammates came to see me. I thought that was great. They encouraged me. And above all, they pointed out how many Arsenal fans around the world didn't like the way the fans reacted in the stadium. When my shirt number lit up on the fourth officials panel and our own fans broke into what he calls gleeful jubilation, that hit me very hard, really upset me. Very hurtful, very frustrating. I can't understand a reaction like that, especially the vehemence of it and the extreme hostility directed against me. I don't mean to say that I can't take criticism. If the team and I don't play well, we must listen and work on it. But insulting and swearing at your own captain will cause upset and a bad atmosphere for the team that you're actually supposed to be supporting. It makes no sense to me. It weakens the team's spirit. And you can be sure I'll keep fighting and putting myself out in every training session. I feel last week has been dealt with and I'm ready. He's been linked with a move to Newcastle in January. He says he's not going anywhere. And obviously people have been saying pretty terrible things about his daughter as well. So he sounds in reasonable spirits.
Yeah.
It's very hard not to take the player's side in all this.
Well, I mean, he does. He spoke about, you know, the sort of how social media now is such, like, it's great for sportsmen in one way. There's a double-edged sword, though, in another way. Like, you can get great access and reveal more yourself and control your image to a degree.
And money.
Yeah, but yeah, of course. And the flip side is you can, if you read the comments, then you will read abuse as a footballer. You will read a lot of abuse.
We had Warren Gatland in earlier and he was saying Reece Priestland, when social media became a big thing, he says it in his book, Reece Priestland was going very well, but he started taking all this stuff to heart, started reading it all, almost kind of fell out of love with rugby, had to move to Bath. to try and get over it. So it's a real thing.
It's a human emotion. It's natural to do it. I mean, Xhaka last month, you know, he's a person. You know, he was going to pull out of a Switzerland big game if his wife gave birth at that, you know, at the time. Like, there's other things going on in his life. The flip side of it is, you know, the football business is an absurd entertainment business to some degree. Like, players have paid a lot of money because of the global interest that they generate, and like, someone's, I'm not saying mental health, but like, obviously this can get on top of people, and you can't just say, well, they earn loads of money, they have to take it. But at the same time, you know, there's a markup that comes with their wages that is reflective of the entertainment industry that they work in. They can't necessarily just play their football and go home, because they profit from other aspects of the game, you know, which is TV and all the other stuff that goes on around it. So you have to take a bit of it. But obviously, it's very personal to be booed by your own fans as you leave the pitch. I can see why you don't like it. And to be honest, there was a theatric aspect to him responding and gesturing to the crowd that I think, if the fans give a bit and the player gives a bit back, I don't think that's an absolute outrage. Yeah, I sort of think, but you know what?
Tough look.
You know, give a bit back.
Yeah, they deserve it back.
And like, it's, you know, it's,
I think people
watch Arsenal every week, of course, though, will have a much, like, it's their obsession. And so as a result, like, they don't have as nuanced a view of it. Like, this is their life. They pay money towards it. You know, they sort of feel entitled to
this is their life. This is their life. I mean, but I'm not entertaining that. I agree with what you're saying, but actually, well,
no, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger in football forums and social media now. Like, this is how a lot of people consume and interact with the game now, and there is a toxic nature to it. I mean,
where Xhaka probably went wrong was throwing the jersey down.
Oh yeah, that's
the killer for him.
That's an act of disrespect. But of course, you know, some of the players who are most virtuous in the public light and don't show any emotion, and they're great pros. Like, they might go in privately and ask for a transfer from the same club.
I heard something from a pro recently.
The one club man
wouldn't thank me for naming him, but if we're talking social media, he was saying that it's getting to the point now where sometimes players have come into a dressing room, got somebody to take a photo of them, like, put weights on me, right, okay, get the photo, and then, like, drop the dumbbells and out of the gym. Like, this is how contrived it's all getting. But it's toxic in the dressing room. You see you're like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, like, I mean,
you're playing to the fans. I'm the one getting abuse.
My big one is a player finding a picture of himself looking sad on the pitch after defeat, and then putting up a picture going, tough day today, you know, but here's a picture of me really feeling it.
Hashtag thanks to the fans, they were great though. Come here, Rio Ferdinand thinks Southgate's hung Sterling out to dry. Just one last very quick story. So this is on Facebook, Rio Ferdinand saying that Gareth's handled being England manager brilliantly up to this point, conducted himself in an admirable way, eloquent, engaging, helping the nation feel like they can have some sort of confidence and respect for the national team. However, this incident could have been handled better. Keep it behind closed doors and deal with it internally, surely. ! He says this stuff is so, like, just is not uncommon in squads full of testosterone. In various squads I've been a part of, I've seen players get punched in the face, ribs broken, nose busted, head kicked like a football.
But that was probably John Hartson and Niall Berkovic, was it? Was he at West Ham around that time?
I'd say he was in the mix then.
He would have been knocking around at that point.
I presume that's the only incident that's happened, but who knows? The main question is, why couldn't this have been handled internally? And as you said, this will get leaked.
I suppose there's been a lot of focus on the attention that Sterling gets. It has been vilified by aspects of the English press sometimes, and you just feel now that the next time Sterling has a bad game, he is going to get comments related to this, like, oh, Sterling, typical, starting on your own teammates on England duty, you know. Yeah. Show a bit more commitment to the cause. So I can see how it feels like it might add to the victimisation of Sterling, which definitely is a thing. But I don't know, like, Sekit's a reasonable enough fella, so I'm surprised. I mean, as I said, I keep going back to it, I'm just surprised that they took this course of action. They must have had some feeling that stuff was going to get out, that they had to do it.
Yeah, it's not ideal. Look, maybe there's people working in the canteen and they're just saying, this was too public. This wasn't in the corner of a training ground, but I'm surprised it's gone public as well.
But even just to make a big dropping them. You could say it happened, then name the squad, he's on the bench, whatever, I don't know. But you can't win sometimes in a job, I accept that.
But I'm with you. I think if Gomez comes to him, which he did, and says, I'm happy, this doesn't need to go any further, then I think you come out and say, media have exaggerated this. This was nothing. This happens every day. Honestly, it's nothing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of shuts it down a bit more, instead of having 3, 4, 5 days of talk about it. And that happens when you're into hashtag day 3 of the international window. Correct. Our football coverage is brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. We're taking a short break and then the ever-brilliant Tim Vickery is going to join us next.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.
Now then, welcome back. So the weather is miserable, Tim Vickery. That's why we thought we would talk to you, because even just talking to you makes it feel a bit sunnier, a bit more Samba-like. Hello.
Yeah, I wish I could help you out, but the weather's fairly miserable over this side of the Atlantic as well. It's very, hence the fact that I'm dressed up in a collar and tie to protect myself against hypothermia. Very disappointing for this time of year.
Now, people watching will understand why I'm commenting on your outfit. People listening, Tim Vickery, this is not how you dress of a casual Monday. You, at the time, you don't have a T-shirt on. What's going on here?
A cold spell, and I do. There is a little bit of a dandy who kind of lives inside of me and wants to come out from time to time. So and today he's coming out.
Wow.
He's gonna party.
I don't usually ask this kind of guy. I'm not a red carpet guy, Tim. But who are you wearing this evening?
Who?
Which designer?
No, this is me on Pelicano shirt, Pelicano tie, a fabulous London-based brand which has the slogan Italian style, British swagger. You put those two together, you got a winning mix.
Well, it's glorious. I've come underdressed for this conversation, but we'll kick on anyway. So, international window upon us. We'll be all watching Ireland against New Zealand on Thursday, and then Brazil against, Ireland against Denmark on Monday. Whereas I presume the game you'll be keeping close attention on is Brazil, Argentina on Friday. Naturally enough, it's in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, you're dealing with global brands here. It's an afternoon kickoff. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon over here, so that will cut down on the amount of people who will be able to watch it. Although in Brazil, it is a holiday, not a holiday in Argentina. Friendly schmendly. We can roll out the line of there's no such thing as a friendly between Brazil and Argentina. Fair enough. But extenuating circumstances. Silly season is coming to an end. Next FIFA dates, you have to wait until March for that one. Next time around, it's the real stuff, World Cup qualification. Now, World Cup qualification in South America is serious business. Argentina came very, very close to failing to make it to the last World Cup. Brazil came close to failing to make it to 2002, which they ended up winning. So this is the last chance for the two coaches to get their squads together and play a couple of games before the serious business starts. So there's plenty of stake, and I think it's a kind of higher risk friendly for both of the coaches here. Now, they met just a few months ago in start of July in the semi-final of the Copa America. Brazil won that one 2-0 fairly comfortably. There was some controversy about the refereeing, but Brazil were clearly the better side on the way to winning that competition. Since then, however, and remember, Brazil were at home, since then, Brazil have played four games and they haven't won any of them. Argentina, under Lionel Scaloni, who was an inexperienced caretaker, who's become the inexperienced permanent coach of Argentina, Argentina have put together some pretty good results since the Copa America, despite the fact that they've been without Lionel Messi. Now, Messi returns to... He was suspended for opening his mouth a little bit too much and moaning about corruption during the Copa America. Messi now returns. So I think the stakes for both sides are a little bit like this. Another game without a victory for Brazil, that will be five on the bounce. That will put the coach under real pressure. For Argentina, that feel-good factor that they've built up over the last four games. They thrashed Mexico in the United States in what was a home game for Mexico. They managed to come back from 2-0 down early against Germany and get a draw there in Germany. And they thrashed Ecuador in a friendly in Spain. So the results have been pretty good. But that could be a house of cards if they lose heavily against Brazil. And you look at the starting lineup that we're expecting from Argentina. There's Messi. There's Aguero returning to the side. He hasn't been called up since the Copa America. And it looks like another centre forward as well, probably Lautaro Martinez of Inter Milan, who's been doing so well recently. Yeah. Now, that's three up. That's a bold way to go against Brazil, especially with Argentina's defensive weaknesses. So, you know, if that all goes wrong, then the feel-good factor at Argentina have built up is destroyed. So I think there are high stakes, even though it's a friendly.
Okay, well, you set that up beautifully. And in your recent piece, you presume, I'm sure rightly as well, that the Brazilian coach would have been glued to Manchester City against Liverpool at the weekend. For various reasons, obviously numerous players involved. But particularly, he's looking at the way Firmino is thriving at Anfield in so many ways. And he's kind of probably scratching his head a little bit, saying, we're not really playing to this guy's strengths. And when you've lost five in the bounce, that might be thought of as a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, as he would admit, the parts aren't quite gelling. When the coach Chichi, when he took over late 2016, second half of 2016, everything clicked instantly. At the moment, nothing is clicking. And part of the explanation for that, I think, could be that he's got a little bit of Liverpool and a little bit of Manchester City, and it's not quite working. I'll explain that. He's still haunted, I think, by that World Cup quarterfinal defeat against Belgium when he came to the conclusion that he'd left his side too open against quality opponents. So how has he tried to balance things up subsequently? He's changed the fullbacks, or they've changed the role of the fullbacks. He now wants the fullbacks not to be auxiliary wingers, as they've been in Brazil for so long. You remember your Cafu and Roberto Carlos bursting up and down the flank. Instead of that, he wants them just to tuck in, be auxiliary midfielders as well, and maybe get forward from time to time as an element of surprise. It's a less physically grueling role. It helps explain why Daniel Alves, although he's not available for these games, that Brazil haven't picked any home base players. Why Daniel Alves, even at his advanced age, is still in the frame for Brazil and is still the captain. And the coach said to me, he said, "What we want now, we don't want Liverpool fullbacks. We want Manchester City fullbacks." But he's got the Liverpool centre-forward, Roberto Firmino, and they haven't been able to get the best out of him. Now, if you look at the way that Liverpool operate, and Firmino is not by any means a conventional number nine. He likes to drop deep. He's got Salah and Mane running past him, getting close to him. And the width is provided by those two magnificent attacking fullbacks. Firmino thrives in a system that Brazil are no longer playing. Now, it hasn't been working, and I'm fascinated to see what Brazil do for these games. They've got Argentina, and then a few days later, they play South Korea. And one option is to go back to, especially the left side, a full-on attacking fullback. They could use Renan Lodi of Atletico Madrid, who's very, very promising in that role. Another possibility, there's been a late call-up for big Wesley Moraes of Aston Villa. Now, for some time, Brazil have struggled with that centre-forward position. Finally, they've brought in an out-and-out centre-forward into the squad. I doubt he'll get much of a run against Argentina, but certainly against South Korea, it might be something that Brazil have a look at, even if as an option off the bench. Because, Firmino doesn't give you a lot of penalty area presence. And in the way that Brazil have been playing, when he drops deep, he's often clashed into the same space as the playmaker, like Felipe Coutinho, or Neymar, as it was last time around. Neymar not available this time. And now, Liverpool, clearly, they don't play with that type of player. They don't have a playmaker. So how to get the best out of Firmino, how to get the parts fitting better for the collective, these are things that Brazil still have to work out. And these two friendlies are important to them for that reason.
Okay, because clearly asking Firmino to lead the line in any kind of traditional sense will end along predictable lines.
Yes, it's not going to happen. And he's been left very isolated with the way that Brazil have played, with the wide men sticking wide, the width supplied by the wide attackers and not by the fullbacks. So it hasn't really been working. Adjustments are needed. I'm fascinated to see what Brazil, under pressure, come up with in these games.
Yeah, okay. And then Argentina, Messi coming back, and you mentioned Aguero and Martinez, and that would be a very attacking approach if they choose to take it. Any obvious factors behind their recent run of good form, the feel-good factor you talked about?
Well, part of it, I think, is Messi. And even though he's been missing, Messi in the Copa America, he clearly decided that he is going to be vocal. He's going to be a spokesman. He's going to talk. It was a very different kind of Messi. And Angel Di Maria, long-term international colleague, was talking about that. He was saying it was such a different Messi. I like this Messi. Now, before, there was always the idea that he stayed on his own and maybe he talked to his old mate Aguero, but wasn't very communicative with everyone else. Different Messi. And getting Messi on board has clearly strengthened the position of the coach, Lionel Scaloni. I think it's probably determining Scaloni being appointed on a permanent basis. There's also an interesting generation of players coming through. They've got a good generation of young midfielders. Ezequiel Palacios of River Plate hasn't been called up this time because of the final of the Libertadores. Nico Dominguez of Vélez Sarsfield, who looks like he's going to Bologna next season. Real deal, genuine article. Alexis McAllister, who Brighton have signed, he's on loan at Boca Juniors at the moment. Talented. So there's some talented players coming through. Lautaro Martinez has had a wonderful few months for club and for country. Mm. The problems for Argentina remain goalkeeper, back four. They don't really have definitive solutions yet in those positions, and that's why it could be such a risky strategy against Brazil, going with Aguero, Lautaro Martinez and Messi. They did it in the Copa America. It worked to a certain extent because Aguero worked so hard. He chased back. You wonder if he'll pay the price for this, for all the work that he put in during this this Premier League season. To take on Brazil with three players of whom you don't expect a great deal of marking, that's a high-risk strategy.
Yeah, it sure is. It sounds like it's going to be a very interesting game. And when we're halfway through the World Cup cycle and Qatar starts coming into focus and we're on the eve, if you take March as being the eve of World Cup qualification resuming, do you look at either group, Tim, and think, you know, with 2 years and things developing nicely, we could have real contenders here?
Well, Argentina are going to have to come up with defenders, fullbacks, centre-backs. You look at the defenders that they've picked. So, in Otamendi, who seems to be surplus to requirements at the moment at Man City, and you wonder really if Man City have made an awful blunder in not replacing him. He remains the senior centre-back. Marcos Rojo also called up. He's had to pull out through injury. These positions, centre-backs, full-backs, goalkeeper, are still a problem for Argentina. And you really can't see them winning a World Cup if they're not going to defend well. From the point of view of Brazil, I think there are promising signs there. They've got a good generation coming through. It's the first call-up now for Rodrigo, the teenager who's made such a great start at Real Madrid and of whom they have huge hopes. There are one or two problems down the line. Their big idea to phase out gradually Thiago Silva at centre-back is Eder Militão, who's not having a good time at Real Madrid so far. That's a little problem, yeah. As well as the collective problems we're talking about in the parts not quite fitting together. Who is the long-term centre-forward going to be? Because surely they need a penalty area operator. Is Wesley Moraes good enough? He's unknown to the Brazilian public, which means that you've got to take your opportunity, because if not, opportunity won't come knocking again. But at this point, looking ahead to the next World Cup, I would have thought that Brazil are better positioned than Argentina, because Argentina, those defensive problems are not going away.
Just a final point regarding the domestic game. It's always good to check in and see what's going on over in that part of the world. The Copa Sudamericana has thrown up a nice story. This is the Europa League version of South America.
That's
is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Kicks off a new era because the tradition over here is the two-legged final, the home and away final. The authorities have changed that this year. It's now a one-off final on a neutral ground. Now, that can provide real problems for the fans, because South America is huge. Distances are vast. Travel is expensive. Income is badly distributed. The reason for the change, I think, is twofold. One, they think it has commercial advantages. They can more easily sell a one-off game in an attractive time slot than two games in the middle of the night European time. And also there's a hope that the quality of the spectacle will be better. You get a good game rather than a game in someone's home ground where the ball boys are hiding the ball and so on.
Yeah.
It hasn't got off to the greatest of starts. The main event, the Libertadores, the Champions League equivalent, the final there is set for Santiago, Chile. When they announced that as a venue, they would have patted themselves on the back and saying, we've got the most stable country in South America. Oh, no, you haven't. Chile has erupted in social protest, and they've had to move the venue to Lima in Peru at huge inconvenience to a number of the fans. With the Sudamericana, the Europa League equivalent, we had two relatively minor sides without a serious title between them. Colón of Argentina, a provincial side, and a team from Ecuador, Independiente del Valle, who are a tiny side who 10 years ago never even played in the Ecuadorian first division. They're a remarkable success story based on producing players, selling them, producing more, selling them, producing more. And they're doing this wonderfully well. Now, this final Asuncion, Paraguay. The problem here, the obvious problem, is the heat this time of year. It was furiously hot. There was a fan who actually died of a heart attack on the way to the game, and the heat is considered a factor. But come game time, suddenly the heavens opened. A real torrential downpour, and within 15 minutes or so, the game, the pitch is unplayable. So we had a suspension of an hour while they waited for the rain to drop off a little bit and try to clean the water off the field. So this move to a one-off final, it seems jinxed at the moment, but not jinxed for Independiente del Valle, who played very, very well. Wonderful, composed football. They got a young Spanish coach. They were collective in defence, little clusters on the ball, fast wingers, and they won a thoroughly deserved 3-1 win with a little bit of late drama. It is a remarkable success story. And the last time that a continental title in South America eluded the big two of Brazil and Argentina, you got to go back to mid-2016 when the Libertadores was won by Atlético Nacional of Colombia, who beat in the final Independiente del Valle. Okay. What a remarkable success story. Little club from Ecuador, they're outperforming giants all over the continent.
Okay, very good. Tim Vickery, as ever, thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Now then, so we're done. Always good to have the brilliant Tim Vickery on, and Dan McDonald, as ever. Just enough time to reveal tonight's competition winner is Conor Martin. Conor Martin, congrats. We asked who put the ball in the net for France after Henry's handball. The answer was, of course, William Gallas. Oh, William. So, Conor, you've won yourself dinner for two at the award-winning brasserie at the Marker Hotel, the luxurious five-star Marker Hotel, no less. That is it for this evening. We'll be on the ground at the Aviva tomorrow, Ireland against New Zealand. John Giles also in studio, looking ahead to the Denmark game. And as ever, OTBAM, who had Robbie Fowler on this morning, if you want to catch up on that, is with you from 7:30. Here in News Talk, Tom Dunn on the way.
Get my ball and yard of grass. I'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Get my ball and yard of spice. Give you a move with guilt like your eyes.